From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we meet one of the rhythm and blues stars of the 50s and 60s, Etta James. She was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame last year. Now you can hear her on a TV commercial for Jaguar, singing her hit At Last. And to get you in the mood for holiday cooking, we feature an interview with Julia Child. She was one of the first people to host a TV cooking show. Also, you can see Woody Allen this Sunday on his first made-for-TV movie. He directed and stars in Don't Drink the Water. David Bianculli has a review. And Stephen Schiff reviews the new film Speechless, starring Gina Davis and Michael Keaton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Defense Secretary William Perry says more than 2,000 Marines are preparing to head for the waters off Somalia. They'll stand by in case President Clinton decides to offer U.S. help as United Nations troops withdraw from Somalia. Perry says he expects a decision from the president within the next few days. Several news services are reporting that former President Jimmy Carter is set to visit the Bosnian capital of Sarajevo this weekend in an attempt to mediate the crisis in Bosnia. Carter's been invited by Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic. However, there's been no confirmation from the Carter Center in Atlanta. Meanwhile, a senior administration official says a visit by the former president could prove helpful if Carter arranges a ceasefire, but not if he begins negotiating a peace treaty. Most House Republicans are welcoming President Clinton's proposals to cut taxes, but many also say there was really nothing new in last night's speech. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
House Majority Leader-to-be Richard Armey of Texas says there were no big surprises in the president's speech last night. He refers to the speech as contract light.
Clearly his proposal, I would call, is contract light. The president makes a proposal 4 months after the Republicans have written their contract. The nation knows the Republicans are committed to that mark for a middle-income tax cut.
The contract Army refers to is, of course, the Republicans' contract with America, which they say they're committed to getting on the floor in the first 100 days of the 104th Congress. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
State and local officials from around the country gathered in Washington, D.C. today to present a united front to the upcoming Congress. NPR's Laura Kanoy has details.
The state and local coalition has two main concerns: a proposed balanced budget amendment and unfunded federal mandates. That's where Congress passes new regulations without any money for localities to carry them out. Ohio Republican Governor George Voinovich said the first Senate bill of the new session would discourage unfunded mandates, and he said when lawmakers did approve such programs, they would have to admit it.
Put it in the context of a deliberate action on their part, rather than what's been happening here in the last dozen or so years, where they just keep passing legislation without any consideration of how it's impacting on our respective jurisdictions.
Coalition members also said they support the goal of a balanced budget amendment, but not if Congress does it by shifting the costs of federal programs onto state and local governments. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up just about 29 points. It stands at 37.94.40. Trading so far today has been heavy. 444 million shares have changed hands. This is NPR in Washington. Federal officials say they're investigating the suspected sabotage of planes belonging to Tower Air, based at New York's Kennedy International Airport. The airline told New York Newsday magazine there have been 5 incidents of sabotage to its Boeing 747s during the past 3 months, but in each case, the tampering was discovered before the planes left the ground. An American Eagle commuter plane made an emergency landing today in Nashville, Tennessee, with its right engine out of commission. The airline says this is the same plane that made an emergency landing yesterday in Knoxville, also with right engine trouble. No one was hurt in either incident. The United States and Canada have avoided going to court in a dispute involving trade in softwood lumber. The two countries have agreed to establish an ongoing dialogue to prevent further trade conflicts. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Canada's subsidy of the timber industry sparked the decade-long dispute. U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor says the two nations have agreed to settle their differences without resorting to litigation. But he also says the U.S. is still concerned about Canada's subsidies. Yesterday, U.S. lumber producers dropped their challenge to a recent binational panel ruling, which found U.S. duties against Canadian softwood imports to be unfair. Cantor says that move paved the way for a new atmosphere of cooperation and conciliation. The withdrawal of the lawsuit allowed the U.S. Commerce Department to refund with interest some $800 million in duties from Canadian lumber companies. The U.S. first imposed the duties in May of 1992, charging that Canada was subsidizing timber exports. Commerce Secretary Ron Brown welcomed the new dialogue and says the United States will establish an interagency team to ensure the consultations are productive and beneficial. The talks are scheduled to begin no later than March 1st. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The post office is gearing up for the busiest day of the year. It expects 250 million pieces of mail on the Monday before Christmas. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Several people have asked me recently if I know anything about the song At Last that's now being used on a TV commercial for Jaguar. Well, it was a hit for rhythm and blues singer Etta James, who recorded it in 1960. That's Etta James you hear singing on the commercial. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with her recorded last August.
At last, my love has come along. My lonely days are over, and life is like a song.
Etta James got her start at the age of 15 when she was discovered by Johnny Otis and began performing on his traveling R&B Revue. By age 17, she had her first hit, Roll With Me Henry, an answer song to Hank Ballard's Work With Me Annie. After establishing herself as a rhythm and blues star in the late 50s and early 60s, her career was eclipsed by changes in pop music. But last year she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Her recent album, Mystery Lady, pays tribute to the great jazz singer Billie Holiday. James performs songs recorded by Holiday, like this one, The Very Thought of You.
The very thought of you, and I forget to do the little ordinary things that everyone ought to do. I'm living in a kind of daydream. I'm happy as a queen, but foolish though it may seem to me, that's everything.
Etta James, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me the story of why you wanted to record a Billie Holiday record.
Well, I thought that since I grew up in I did my teenage years in San Francisco, and my mother was such a Billie Holiday and a jazz fan, mostly Billie Holiday. And I kind of, all along, I said, what, jazz? You know, so to me, as a young kid, that was like, it was too disciplined, it was too confining, at least that's the way I thought. And I thought you had to be really, really cool and had to be bourgeois, you know, to do that. And I didn't want to do that. I mean, I was a sloppy kid with tattoos all over. I wanted to be just wild. I really think that I had to mature. I got to the point where I'm 56 years old. I think it took me maturing.
Now, let me ask you this. You grew up in a foster home. I think when your mother had you, she was 14 years old.
Right. She was a kid. And, you know, I had feelings about all that kind of stuff for years, and I went to therapy and all about it. But then as I got older, I realized that she really she really did the best for me. She put me in a lovely home. The people were, you know, lovely to me. They never said that they were my real parents. I mean, I always knew I had this good-looking, you know, high-stepping mom, and she was like only 14 years older than me. And so she did the best for me, because if she had tried to take me with her, she was just a child, what would she have done with me? Would I have been singing today? Would I have been anything, you know?
What was your foster family like?
They were lovely. They were older people. And they had property, and they lived in the east side, lower east side of Los Angeles. And my grandmother was a church lady, and they believed in, you know, they gave me singing lessons at five. And
When you were singing in the church choir, did your grandmother or anyone else in the family get upset if on your own time you sang blues or any kind of secular music?
No, because my grandmother died when I was 12. So I sing gospel music from 5 until 12. And so my grandmother, she wasn't one of those kind of people, because I was already the prodigy child of the church. And, you know, and I did nothing but, and I loved church. I went to Bible camp, and I was a little Christian girl. And until my grandmother passed away at 12, that is when my mother came to get me. Because I had nothing but my grandfather there in the house, and my mother wanted me to be with her. And she came the day of the funeral to pick me up, to take me back to San Francisco. So that's at San Francisco. Oh, I was listening to little stuff on the sly, but I wasn't interested in secular music. But when once I got to San Francisco, I grew horns and a tail. And I really turned into, you know, the real street kid. I was kind of like a runaway, but I had a mother, you know what I mean? And I had a place to stay.
You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to play one of your rhythm and blues recordings that has a very gospel sound to it. Now, I want to play Something's Got a Hold on Me from 1961. Do you think of this as having a gospel sound?
Matter of fact, it is a gospel song. We wrote that song, and we adapted it from a gospel song, and the gospel song was Something's Got a Hold on Me, It Must Be the Lord.
And in your song, it must be love.
It must be love, right, right. Now, don't get me, because I'm not the one who decided to, but I was one of the writers. I just kind of said, okay, well, let's go, rock and roll.
This is Etta James, recorded in 1961.
Oh, sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah. Yeah, I get a feeling that I never, 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 never had before. No, no. Yeah, I just wanna tell you right now that ooh, I believe, I really do believe that something's got a hold on me. Yeah.
That's Etta James, recorded in 1961. She has a new album, which we'll be hearing from a little more later, called Mystery Lady, featuring songs of Billie Holiday. Well, it wasn't too long after you moved in with your mother that you actually went on the road. I mean, Johnny Otis, who had a now famous rhythm and blues touring review, got you into the show. He discovered you. But how did you audition for him? How did you find him, or he find you?
Well, kind of, yeah, I think it was kind of a little bit of both, really. But he really found me, because at that time, my mother, I had ran away from home. And I went and I stayed with two girls, one named Abby and Jean, who later became the Peaches. You know, it used to be Etta James and the Peaches. And we had wrote an answer to the song Work With Me, Annie.
The Hank Ballard record.
Right. So during those days, you know, everybody would make an answer. You said, work with me, Annie. Then we said, roll with me, Henry. And so one night, the young girl and myself, we were the same age. I think we were both like 16. And the older sister was like 24. And she went out to a dance in the Fillmore District, which was, you know, a heavy drag district of San Francisco. She went to see the Johnny Otis Band. And she was there because we couldn't go, and we didn't want to go anyway. We were, like, you know, different from her. We weren't, like, she was kind of like a groupie kind of a chick.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of, like, scared, you know, to do that. So all of a sudden, we got a call that night, and it was Abby calling us back to say, listen, guess who I'm with? I'm with Johnny Otis. And we go, oh, Johnny Otis. And he said, yeah, Johnny Otis. I told him that we have a girl group, and he says he wants to hear us. And I said, yeah, right. How does he want to hear us? We're out there in the project in the boonies, right? And she says, oh, he's at the hotel there and all the band and everything. And myself and the girl, we looked at each other and said, yeah, right. Now we're 15-year-olds and we're going to go to the hotel with the band and Johnny Otis. Johnny Otis was like about a 34, 35-year-old man. So we said, oh, no, that's all right. That's all right. We'll cool that and everything. So Johnny Otis snatched the phone from her. And it was Johnny Otis. You know, we heard that voice, you know. And he said, hi, how you doing? And we said, oh, we're doing all right. He says, I hear you guys got a great group. I hear you got a song, a couple of songs, and I'd like to hear you. And he says, how about catching a cab? I'll pay the cab fare, and I'll meet you out front. And I said, oh, no, now this is getting heavy. This older man is going to, you know, send us in a cab. So we said, okay, let's go on. John, he sounded pretty sincere. And he said, don't worry, nobody's going to bother. He says, okay. So we got up and got dressed, got in the cab, and went down there. Sure enough, as we pulled up, we saw this tall man. You know, we'd all seen pictures of Johnny Otis with the nice hair, and he looked like a tall, kind of like a Creole man with a nice mustache and a beard, and he had, you know, and the nice pompadour hair. And he was standing there all stately, and he had two or three more guys with him. One guy was his manager, was a much older man. And when we got there, he said, oh, I'm glad to see you, and come on up and let's hear you. So we went upstairs to his room and we sang How Deep Is the Ocean and For All We Know and Street of Dreams.
So you auditioned for Johnny Otis. He liked your singing, I suppose,
right?
And invited you to go on the tour, but you were still a minor. Did you have to get your mother's permission?
Well, that was a trick there. I knew my mother wasn't going to let me go. But I told him, he says, how old are you? I said, 18, which he knew that was a lie. And he says, well, you know what? I would like to take you guys to Los Angeles tomorrow to make a record. And he says, can I speak with your mother? I said, no, I can't find her right now. She's working. And he says, well, can you go home and get permission from your mother, get something in writing stating that you can travel, and give me your mother's address and phone number and all this stuff, and saying that you can travel and you're allowed to travel with me, and have her to sign it and date it. I said, oh, yeah, I can do that. So sure enough, that's what I did. I went home. I wrote the note.
Oh, I see. Right. I see.
And I brought the note back with a tiny little bag, a little plastic bag or something with some clothes in it. And myself and the two girls got on Johnny's bus and we split to L.A.
So why don't we hear the first song that you recorded? And this was the first song recorded after going on the road with Johnny Otis. And it's Roll With Me, Henry, also called Wallflower.
And called Dance With Me, Henry.
Called Dance With Me, Henry, also. And this is Etta James.
Hey, baby, what do I have to do to make you love me too?
You got to roll with me, Henry.
All right, baby.
Roll with me, Henry.
Don't mean maybe.
Roll.
Stop your stalling.
No, after you recorded this, Georgia Gibbs did a cover recording of this called "Dance with Me, Henry," and right. was that supposed to be the tamer version?
Yeah. Well, you know, during those days, you weren't allowed to say "roll," because "roll" was like a vulgar word. You know what I mean? Think about it. They would probably burn Prince at the stake. Right? But you couldn't say "roll." So rather than they banned my record from the air. And what happened? What we had to do was sell it underground, and not only that, change the title to "Wallflower." And then when Georgia Gibbs did it, she just made the "Dance with Me, Henry," so that, you know, all the kids could go buy it and, you know, take it home and, you know, listen to it, because their parents weren't going to go for no roll. Are you kidding? Roll with me? How do you roll with somebody?
On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring an interview with Etta James, recorded last August. More of that interview after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer Etta James. At some point in your career, you started dressing in evening gowns for performances and dyeing your hair blonde. Tell me how you created that onstage image for yourself.
I think probably by me being so young, and I was oversized like I am now, but I mean, I had a real nice figure and I was tall. And I remember this singer, Joyce Bryant. She was a black singer, and I always admired her. And I had two role models. I liked Joyce Bryant because she wore sequin fishtail gowns, and she was black, and she had the nerve to wear platinum hair. And then I also loved Jane Mansfield, because Jane Mansfield had the blonde hair and had the poochy lips and the mole and all this. So I think what I did was kind of combined. My mother had bleached my hair carrot red at one point, and then I said, well, maybe that's not flamboyant enough. So I just kind of went into Detroit one day, and one of the fellas over there said, oh, Miss James, why, you would probably look fabulous with platinum hair. So he bleached my hair blonde, and it looked good, and then I started, what I was doing was trying to be a glamour girl, because I had been a tomboy most of the time, and I wanted to look grown. You know, I wanted to wear tall, high-heeled shoes and fishtail gowns and big, long rhinestone earrings, you know.
So how long did you dye your hair?
For how long?
Yeah.
I think, most of my career. It was blonde, platinum blonde, all the way, I would think, up into the 70s, maybe the 72 and 73, something like that.
And why'd you stop?
Well, I think things had changed. I know things had changed, and my career wasn't happening. And I didn't think that I needed to be that, you know, to attract that much attention. Another thing, I was on drugs at that time, and I think I really wanted a low profile.
Hmm. Wait, was it difficult for you to give up drugs?
Not when I got down to, you know, I'd given it up many a time. You know, mm-hmm. I'd kicked my habits many a time. But when I went in 1974, I gave heroin up. I was on methadone for maybe 3 or 4 years before that. So I had a couple of things to give up.
Was it hard to make a comeback after you stopped using?
No, not really, because when I stopped using, I wasn't the kind that went around and wanted people to pat me on the back about it. It's just that I just picked up the the ball and started running with it. The thing was, when I went to this rehabilitation center, I was around nothing but a lot of white kids. And the thing where they were all younger than I was. And I remember on Saturdays, they would play all these great rock and roll records. The thing was, I was doing R&B, remember? But the ZZ Tops and the Rod Stewarts and the Rolling Stones and all those people, I was busy using drugs. I wasn't there when Woodstock. I was there in New York when Woodstock was going on, but I didn't want to go to Woodstock. I would rather go to Harlem, you know? And when I was in the program on Saturdays, we'd be cleaning up. They would be playing songs from all these people. And I would say, "Ooh, man, that music is really happening." And then what really made me think it is because my song, "I'd Rather Go Blind," they had a version of it by Rod Stewart. And they kept saying, "Hey, this is the song you wrote. Listen." And I said, "All right."
In 1978, you opened in some cities for the Rolling Stones on their tour. Were the Stones fans of yours?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Matter of fact, when I was in rehab at the same rehab center in the 70s, 74 and 75, I got a letter from Keith Richards that had said to me that they were getting ready to do a tour. You know, they had Tina Turner and they had B.B. King and they had different people on their tour. And they had wanted me on their tour. And the letter that they wrote came to the rehabilitation center, and the therapist got the letter, and he called me to his office and read the letter, and the letter said that he said, "We would like to have you on tour with us. We love your music." And he says, "But what you're doing right now is more important than what we could ever do with you, but we'll be sure to come back and get you when you're ready." And that was really cool. That was when they came back in 78 and kept their word.
I'd like to close our interview with another selection from your new album of songs that were recorded by Billie Holiday. I thought we could play "How Deep Is the Ocean," since this is one of the songs you sang many years ago when you auditioned for Johnny Otis. What do you think is the difference between what the song means to you now and what it meant to you then, and how you sing it now and how you sung it then?
I think probably it's because now I really understand, you know what I mean? I understand what I'm singing about. You know, songs that I get, any song that I decide to sing or a song that someone sends to me or recommends, I like to be able to relate to that song, not just, you know, have a song there that talks about "Come fly me to the moon, let me dangle on the stars." That's not my cup of tea. That's not real. I want to sing real stuff. I want to know what I'm singing about, and I want to be able to really relate to that, and I think that's what I can do now. I think that's what I definitely do. Matter of fact, I know I do.
Etta James, it's been a pleasure. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Etta James recorded last August. Her latest records are "Etta James Live from San Francisco," featuring a 1981 concert, and "Mystery Lady," her tribute to Billie Holiday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
How much do I love you? I'll tell you no lie. How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you?
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. With the holidays coming up, chances are there's a lot of cooking or eating in your future. Coming up from the archives, an interview with one of America's most famous cooks, Julia Child. Also, Woody Allen stars in his first made-for-TV movie this Sunday night. David Bianculli reviews Don't Drink the Water, co-starring Julie Kavner and Michael J. Fox, written and directed by Woody Allen. And film critic Stephen Schiff takes a look at Speechless, starring Gina Davis and Michael Keaton. Their on-screen relationship is similar to the real-life one between James Carville and Mary Madeline, but the movie script was written before the 1992 election. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. More than 2,000 U.S. Marines will soon be heading towards Somalia. Defense Secretary William Perry says they'll stand by in case President Clinton decides to offer U.S. help as U.N. troops withdraw from Somalia. That decision is expected to be announced later today. No comment from the Carter Center in Atlanta to news reports that former President Jimmy Carter may leave for Bosnia as early as this weekend to try to negotiate a ceasefire. Officials from the State Department and CIA flew to Atlanta today to brief Carter on the focus they'd like any mediation to take. State Department spokesman Mike McCurry explains.
Specifically, the things that were suggested by the ministers on December 2nd, a ceasefire, an immediate ceasefire around Bihać, continuation of a ceasefire and no hostilities around safe areas and Sarajevo in particular, and then a cessation of hostilities countrywide throughout Bosnia-Herzegovina for a lasting period.
However, the Clinton administration does not want Carter to attempt to negotiate a treaty between warring factions. Reaction today to President Clinton's proposal to cut taxes for millions of middle-income voters. David Keating of the National Taxpayers Union says the president proposed his plan as a way to catch up to Republicans.
He hadn't proposed this before in any real way since the 1992 election. During the 1992 election, candidate Clinton was talking about a middle-class tax cut, and what he delivered the next year, 1993, was a middle-class tax increase. So I think he's definitely playing catch-up to the Republicans right now, and we'll have to see if he manages to keep the pace.
This year's midterm elections were the most expensive in American history, $590 million in all. NPR's Peter Overby has more.
Republican Senate candidates spent almost $150 million, about $35 million more than their Democratic rivals. That margin came mostly from two Senate hopefuls who lost, Michael Huffington and Oliver North. On the House side, Democrats spent $30 million more than the Republicans. But in the 52 races where no incumbent was running, races that were crucial to the GOP takeover of the House, Republicans had the financial edge. The new figures raise questions about the future of political action committees. PACs have heavily supported Democrats, and Republicans have demanded elimination of PAC money as part of any campaign reform effort. But this year, Republicans running for open seats got more than 20% of their money from PACs. And with Republicans now running Congress, the GOP and the PACs may find new common ground. This is Peter Overby. In Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials closed up 41.75 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News in Washington. The American Eagle commuter airline has been forced to suspend flights into Chicago and five other Midwest cities because pilots say they need more training on procedures for cold weather flying. Last week, the carrier grounded its entire Chicago-based fleet of ATP turboprops after the FAA ruled those planes may not fly in icing conditions. The company brought in some Saab-made planes to replace them, but the pilots' union is demanding more training. In China's continuing crackdown on pro-democracy forces, a court in Beijing has sentenced 9 political dissidents to jail terms of up to 20 years. The 9 were charged with conducting counter-revolutionary activities. The BBC's Humphrey Hoffley reports from Beijing.
Those in court were mostly arrested in mid-1992 during a police operation in several parts of China. They were accused of forming underground dissident groups in Beijing, Sichuan, Hunan, and other provinces. The heaviest sentence was handed down to a 39-year-old lecturer, Hu Shugen. He was jailed for 20 years after being arrested in his Beijing apartment. The police say they found a large amount of pro-democracy literature there and accused him of being a leader of a counter-revolutionary group. Robin Munro of Human Rights Watch said the sentences were almost unprecedentedly harsh. They were the latest clear evidence disproving the argument that economic reform would lead to political liberalization in China. In fact, he said, as the economy boomed, the authorities became more nervous about dissent.
Humphrey Hawksley reporting. The militant Islamic Hamas group held a mass rally in Gaza City today to mark the 7th anniversary of its founding. More than 10,000 Hamas supporters packed Gaza's largest football field to hear speeches by Hamas leaders who are opposed to the Israeli PLO peace deal. Activists burned an effigy of Israeli Prime Minister Rabin. I'm Anne Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The upcoming holiday weekends are the two biggest food weekends of the year. So on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1989 interview with one of America's most celebrated chefs, Julia Child. With her 1961 book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Julia Child helped introduce Americans to classic French cuisine. In 1963, she started her long-running TV series, The French Chef. She'll be back on public TV this spring with a new season of her series, Cooking with the Master Chefs. Julia Child grew up in Pasadena, California. I asked her what food she ate as a girl.
I grew up in the teens and the 20s when most people had, middle class people had maids or had someone to help. And we had very sensible New England type food because my mother came from New England. Of, you know, roasts and vegetables and fresh peas and mashed potatoes. But nobody discussed food a great deal because it just wasn't done. And there was no wine served at the table, at least not in my family, who were very conservative. We always ate very well, but it wasn't talked about.
Well, your family had a cook. Did your mother cook at all, and did you learn to cook at all?
No, she really didn't cook at all. She knew how to make baking powder biscuits and... Welch rabbit, and that's all she knew how to make. And I didn't do any cooking then, at all.
You're over 6 feet tall,
mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you were a very tall girl.
I'm the smallest in my family, however.
Oh, no. were you very athletic, and did you...
Oh, very, uh-huh. Yes. I played tennis and golf and all kinds of things. I was very, very athletic, because one was in California anyway, because you could... do outdoor activities.
Were you comfortable with your height, or were you self-conscious about it?
Well, I didn't like dancing school when I was much taller than the boys. But, I don't know, I got used to it perfectly easily.
Mm-hmm. When you graduated from college, you went to New York with the mm-hmm. hopes of becoming a novelist or of writing for a magazine. Yeah?
Or writing for The New Yorker, or at least getting into Time or Newsweek. Nobody wanted me for some strange reason.
Why did you want to write, and were you sure that you wanted to have a career?
Well, I was. I thought I was romantic about the idea of writing or being on the stage. In those days, too, everyone was fascinated with the theater. But I wanted to do one or the other, and then I got a job at W&J Sloan's furniture store in advertising and publicity, which I enjoyed very much.
Mm-hmm.
And then along came the war, and I went down to Washington and eventually got into the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS.
Did you want to be a spy?
I did want to be a spy, and I thought I'd be a very good one because no one would think that someone as tall as I would possibly be a spy. But, of course, I ended up doing menial office work. I was in the files the whole time, which it was fascinating as an organization to be in, and at least I knew everything that was going on.
Well, you were telling us how being in the OSS led you overseas. You lived mm-hmm. for a while in China. I think you lived for a while in India.
Yep. Ceylon. It was Ceylon in China.
Mm-hmm. And then after the war, you're telling us you went to Washington, then went back to Paris, mm-hmm. went to Paris and lived there. This was in the late 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
So you had wonderful food in Paris.
It was just marvelous. It was still the old classical cuisine. It was just delicious. I've never had such good food again as we had then.
Well, how did eating wonderful food lead you to want to start preparing wonderful food?
Well, I was very much impressed with the food, and I just had, having started in cooking after we got married, I decided I would go to the Cordon Bleu, and they had kind of a classes for what we call fluffies. What it did at that same time, they were having some classes for the GIs on the Bill of Rights, and I decided after doing a little bit that I would really like to do much more serious delving into cuisine so that I was able to join the GIs. And they didn't object, luckily. And we started in at 7 in the morning and finished at around 11. And then I would rush home and prepare a fancy lunch for my husband, Paul. In those days, too, the American Embassy followed the two-hour lunch, French lunch hour, so we always came home for lunch. And then, but in those days, too, middle-class women were not going into cooking, either the French or the Americans. And the French, of course, all had maids. It was the way we had lived before the war in the USA.
So the other students were mostly chefs?
So nobody, no people that I knew, either French or American, were at all interested in the mechanics of cooking. But then at some party through a mutual friend, I met my colleague Simon Beck, Simka, who was, as I was, tremendously interested in cooking, but she knew a great deal about it. She'd worked with old Henri Pellepas and so forth. And eventually, because we began working together, eventually we started a little cooking school called L'École des Trois Gourmands. And Simka and her friend Louisette were writing a book on French cooking for Americans, and they needed a collaborator. So that's how eventually Volume 1 of Mastering came into being.
Mastering the Art of French
Mastering
Cooking.
Mastering the Art of French Cooking, you know.
On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring a 1989 interview with Julia Child. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Julia Child, when you co-wrote Mastering the Art of French Cooking, did you see it as a way to introduce Americans to French cuisine?
Yes, I was tremendously interested in French cuisine because it's the only cuisine that has the real rules on how to cook. And because I had started in quite late. I was about in my early 30s when I started cooking. And I found that the recipes in all the books I had were really not adequate. They didn't tell you enough. And I'm, for one, I won't do anything unless I'm told why I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that we needed fuller explanations so that if you followed one of those recipes, it should turn out exactly right. And that's why the recipes are very long, but they have full detail. And my feeling is that once you know everything and have digested it, then it becomes part of you.
You became nationally famous in the United States for your cooking show. I read that your cooking show started because you were a guest on someone else's show when your book Mastering the Art of French Cooking mm-hmm. came out, and there was such a big response that they gave you your own show.
At that time when they did a book review. And I had to do something. You can't just talk about it. So I beat up some egg whites in a big copper bowl, that kind of thing that people had not seen before. And I made an omelet. And at that time, there were no cooking shows at all on television. And people said, well, why don't we have a cooking show? And so I did 3 pilots. And they got a lot of response because there weren't any on at that point. And French cooking was very much in vogue. And at that time also, public television was mostly talking heads. And they wanted to have something that was a little more lively. And so that's how it really started in.
Were your early shows live?
No, nothing was live, but the early shows, because we were very, very, very strict budget, it was really live on tape.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we started in, we didn't stop at all, unless there was a terrible disaster, and we only had about two or three, I think.
Tell me one of the terrible disasters.
Well, one time I was cooking, blanching some broccoli, and it was in a salad basket, which was lowered into a big kettle, and when I picked it up, my fork slipped and it all fell on the floor. I didn't pick it up and use it, so we did stop because it was a real mess. But every time we stopped, it would cost, several hundred dollars because it always took half an hour to get back again, and you'd have to pay overtime. And another time there was a short circuit on my microphone, and every time I touched the stove, the microphone would go and I'd clutch my breast. So we had to stop for that. But otherwise, we just didn't stop at all. Then people would say, well, I saw you drop that chicken on the floor, which, of course, I never did. All I did was flip a potato pancake into the stove, and then I put it back into the pan, and I said, well, if you're all alone in the kitchen, nobody will know. It's funny that people saw me do that to a chicken. Isn't that funny how people will say that?
So were there often mistakes in the actual show that you would recover from, thinking that, well,
yes,
this kind of thing happens all the time to real cooks?
And I think some people would accuse me of doing things purposely, but anyone who's been in the kitchen knows that awful things happen all the time. And you just, if you're a cook, you have to make do with whatever happens.
I'm sure you must have seen the Dan Aykroyd Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yes, we have a tape of that. That's great fun.
What he'd always do is, when he was doing you, is take little nips of wine until he got really giddy while he was cooking.
I know, and then people accuse me of that, too, which, of course, I know Frank Pryle of the New York Times said that he saw me pick up a bottle and drink out of it, which, of course, I would never do in public. But I think his book didn't sell very well, so I don't care. No, I would never. I mean, would be a very gauche thing to do in public, wouldn't it?
Julia Child recorded in 1989. You can see her on public television this spring when she begins a new season of her series Cooking with Master Chefs. Coming up, we take a look at a new movie that just opened. Director Ron Underwood had a small-scale hit with his first film, Tremors, in 1990. But it wasn't until 1991 that he made a big splash in Hollywood with his second movie, City Slickers. The success of that film meant that he could command bigger budget and bigger stars, like Michael Keaton and Gina Davis, the co-stars of Underwood's new romantic comedy. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Speechless.
Underwood and his screenwriter, Robert King, have hastened to assure the world that their movie was conceived and written 2 years before the big romance between the rival campaign spinners Mary Matlin and James Carville. That's too bad, because though Speechless has its charms, it could have used a lot more of what Mary and James have. Eccentricity, vulgarity, juice. The setting is New Mexico, where the Democratic candidate for senator is a distinguished-looking stiff named Wanamaker. And the Republican is a scary smoothie named Garvin, and the race is neck and neck. Wanamaker's chief speechwriter is Julia, played by Gina Davis. And she has a problem. She's an insomniac. So is Garvin's new speechwriter, Kevin, played by Michael Keaton. In fact, they meet fighting over the last pack of Nidol in the hotel drugstore. Naturally, they fall in love. And naturally, they conceal from each other their real occupations. What they have going for them, besides the fact that they're both awake at the same time, is not so much chemistry as similarity. Underwood has directed Keaton and Davis to have the same rhythms, the same double takes. Actually, if you looked at the screenplay and covered up the names, you'd probably find it impossible to distinguish Julia's lines from Kevin's. They're written in exactly the same breezily bantering style. All of which, for a while at least, is fairly pleasant, as in this scene, in which Kevin and Julia are sitting in bed looking at one another's driver's license photos.
Yeah, those are my serial killer ears. Did you just snort?
No.
Yes, you did. You laughed and then you snorted. There you go. Yeah, you're snort laughing. It's a common thing. Actually, you could have used a snort laugh here. Ooh, but your bad attitude.
I hate when people say smile.
Yeah, guess so.
Me, I hate it when movies say smile. And this one keeps saying it long after you feel like complying. The problem with speechless is that, smile as you may, you never feel much like laughing. In fact, you never feel much of anything at all because the movie remains so relentlessly conventional and mild. It shouldn't have been. Hidden behind its premise is an unstated outrage that these two rival spin doctors can fall in love precisely because they're exactly alike. Their beliefs don't differ enough to divide them because they have no beliefs. That's a shocking and sadly realistic assessment of the state of the American political process, but the movie makers don't seem to realize it. About midway through, they do give Julia a smidgen of idealism, but in this case, the cure is worse than the disease, and you feel relieved when the movie stops glowing virtuously and gets back to the mechanics of its plot, which unfortunately get more mechanical with every passing scene. Speechless starts brightly and then spends 98 minutes dimming. But Davis and Keaton do work well together. They can toss quips around like acrobats juggling tenpins. I'm not sure you'd call that chemistry. Tracy and Hepburn, Gable and Lombard, Gary Cooper and Gene Arthur, their chemistry was a combustible marriage of opposites, and it produced a lot of heat. Davis and Keaton are a pleasant couple, but all they produce in the end is fizz.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. You can stay home this weekend and watch Woody Allen's first made-for-TV movie. We'll have a review in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Time to see what's coming up on All Things Considered. And as a special bonus, we have two hosts, Robert Siegel and Linda Wertheimer.
Hello,
take
Terry.
It away.
How are you?
Hi, Terry. We're talking about the president's speech last night today, and we're getting a couple of people in to say what they thought about it, and they weren't too crazy about it. Martin Anderson from Stanford and Paul Tsongas from Massachusetts.
Terry, you're familiar with Deadheads?
Yeah.
You're Grateful Dead fans?
Yes,
tonight.
Yes.
Tiny Heads, fans of Tiny Tim, who've hung in all through the years.
Also, we've got more on Orange County, what kind of portfolio Orange County was holding on to. And we'll be listening to the Boys Choir from the National Cathedral.
Well, thank you both. Those are some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Sunday night, ABC presents Woody Allen in his first TV performance in 25 years, since he created and starred in the Woody Allen special for Kraft Music Hall. This time, he's starring in Don't Drink the Water, a brand-new telemovie version of his 1966 Broadway comedy. TV critic Deva Bienkuli has a review.
If you're wondering why Woody is doing this TV special, and doing it now, here's the deal. Between pictures, he was talking with his sister and her business partner, who run a TV production company based in New York. The subject of Don't Drink the Water came up, and Woody mentioned, just casually, that he always liked that play and thought it would be fun to star in the lead role now that he was old enough. The very next day, Woody's sister called back with a firm deal from ABC. If he'd make it and star in it, they'd let him do it any way he wanted and be proud to show it. So he said okay. The cast fell into place almost immediately, and after 3.5 weeks of shooting, Woody Allen had directed and starred in his first made-for-TV movie. And it's wonderful. Woody plays Walter Hollander, a caterer from New Jersey who's on vacation with his wife and daughter in an Iron Curtain country in 1961. The family is accused of spying and takes refuge in an American embassy, run at the moment by a young and very inexperienced ambassador. The communists surround the embassy, forcing the family to stay for weeks and weeks while planning an escape. Meanwhile, back in the States, Walter's catering business is being run into the ground by his partner, who accidentally served tainted meat at a party. When a movie version of Don't Drink the Water was made in 1969, without Allen's cooperation or input, it starred Jackie Gleason as Walter and Estelle Parsons as his wife. She was fine, but Gleason was miscast, too tough and loud in what was written as a more neurotic role.
Children.
There you have it.
Let me have it. Hello, Sam. Sam, I want you to hear this. I'm coming home, Sam. And when I get back, I'm going to rent a car and I'm going to run you over. Run you right over. You're through in the catering business, Sam. You're finished. You've chopped your last liver.
This new version, though, has Woody as Walter and Julie Kavner as his wife. They're perfect together, and both the laughs and the characterizations are much less forced. Here's the same scene. Judge for yourself.
Hello?
I got such a heartburn.
Yes? What? No, hold it. It's New Jersey, Sam. You be nice. We all make mistakes.
Hello. Hello, Cretan? Hello, does Cretan poison any more people, Cretan? Well, four more people went. They're dropping like flies. Uh-huh. So what's happening? What'd he say? Good. The lawyer thinks they have a case. Uh-huh. Murderer? I can't hear you. Your voice is fading, murderer. Overseas operator, I can't hear the murderer.
Woody directs this ABC movie just like he directs his motion picture films. Scenes are shot in long, unbroken takes without close-ups. You get to see all the actors at the same time. And with this cast, that's a definite plus. The young diplomat is played by Michael J. Fox in his first TV role since leaving Family Ties. The Hollander's daughter is played by Mayim Bialik of Blossom, who's surprisingly good here. And as for surprises, nothing beats the casting and the performance of Dom DeLuise as a fellow refugee at the embassy. He's an absolute riot. And when he and Fox are doing a scene together, you can almost feel them feeding off each other's energy. Woody has updated his script a little, adding some jokes and deleting others. But Don't Drink the Water still works as a sort of a Woody Allen flashback. It's a quiet little delight. And if you like the Woody Allen of Bananas vintage, you'll enjoy this remake of Don't Drink the Water, too. Woody Allen is happy with the results. And so am I.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at the fastest-growing Christian movement on Earth, Pentecostalism. We talk with theologian Harvey Cox. His new book is about the rise of Pentecostal spirituality. Also, part two of our interview with Youssef Ibrahim, regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.